We started last week a quick study of the book of Philemon. It'll be quick because the book is very short. If you missed it last week, I would encourage you to hear it online and hurry. Last week was the introduction. Next week is the conclusion. And today, in the big middle, we're going to be thinking about how to make a loving appeal to another person. Now, this is essentially what the book of Philemon is about. Paul is appealing to his Christian brother Philemon for the sake of a new convert named Onesimus. This new convert, before he was saved, had harmed Philemon. He had been a slave in Philemon's household, and he had run away. He had betrayed a trust. He had left Philemon in the lurch, and now he's come to Christ under Paul's ministry in Rome, and Paul is concerned that as he sends Onesimus back to Philemon, that he might not be received in the way that a new Christian ought to be received into the church and ought to be received by a leader in the church, which is what Philemon was. And so he wants to put that issue to rest. He's afraid that the past may be more of an issue than it should be. And so Paul sends this really wonderful letter to smooth the way. He wants to be sure that Philemon sets aside the hurt and the anger and the frustration of the past and welcomes Onesimus as a new believer ought to be welcomed into the church and into his life personally. He wants Philemon to be free of any guilt that would come by holding on to past offenses or mistreating someone who is under his power. He wants the church at Colossae to continue to have harmony, to avoid any unpleasant divisions, any finger-pointing, or any conflict that might arise out of this tension that could come now with these two being put back in proximity with each other. He wants Onesimus to be well established in the faith, to be able to continue the discipleship that he started under Paul in Rome for that brief time. He wants this guy to be able to grow in his faith without becoming disillusioned, which can be very hard on you if it happens early. You just became a Christian, hasn't been but a few weeks, and somebody pounds on you pretty hard for the wrong reasons. And so Paul doesn't want that to happen. There's a lot at stake. This is a personal issue that affected a couple of lives, but those lives are very important. How those men relate to each other is very important. And what they do with it is going to affect a lot of other people in the church, and that is important. And how the whole thing turns out depends primarily on what Philemon does and whether he does what he ought to do anyway, what any Christian ought to do. That's what it hinges on, whether Philemon will do the right thing. You know that's hard sometimes, especially if you're hurt or mad or embarrassed. And so Paul wants to remind this Christian brother to hold himself to the standard that every Christian is to hold to, and he sends this letter for that purpose. Now, if you've ever tried to give that particular flavor of encouragement to another Christian, then you've got an idea of what Paul is up against here. This is not an easy letter to write, at least it wouldn't be for most of us. When somebody's feelings are hurt, when somebody's mad, or when they're a little bit embarrassed because they've been made to look foolish in front of the whole town, they don't always take a challenge the way they ought to. It's hard to challenge them. There's a lot there. And you wonder how they're going to respond, and you wonder quite what to say, how to word it so that you won't make it worse. Now, it's possible that all of those factors were in play here. Philemon was probably mad and hurt, and it's certain that the whole town knew about this, and the church knew about this, and they're going to continue to know about it as it unfolds when the guy gets back to town, and it's very likely that Philemon's going to encounter a little ridicule from the lost world if he doesn't come down hard on the slave that ran away. You know, you got to nip it in the bud, man. What are you doing? And so there's a lot in play. And Philemon would be a very unusual man if it didn't affect him at all. And all of that stuff makes it hard to forgive and to forget, to be reconciled and to be restored. It makes it hard to have mercy and graciously welcome back someone who was in the wrong. And if you've ever seen this coming and thought, well, let me put a word in now before it happens, you know what Paul was up against. To try to challenge somebody in advance. You have to be much more careful if they haven't messed up yet. You don't want to make them think you expect them to mess up. You got to word it so that you're not offensive to even bring the subject up. And so it calls for some wisdom and some careful thought. Well, if the situation comes up that puts you in Paul's spot, where you need to offer in advance some words of encouragement so that people will keep on doing or will prepare themselves to do what they ought to do anyway, then what are you going to say? You know, this is an important part of our lives together in this world as Christians, within God's church. He's left us here. He's given us to each other. We have a purpose. We have responsibilities to each other. And this is one of the more difficult aspects of our responsibility to each other. We're here for mutual encouragement and admonition and edification. We're supposed to consider how to encourage one another to love and good deeds. It means you're thinking about it, Hebrews 10. And then you follow through on that, obviously, or what would be the point? This is one of the more difficult categories. What do you say? Preserving and even strengthening a friendship with your words in a situation that's already awkward and has potential to become much more awkward. Well, that's what's going on in this book. And this morning I want to look at the specific appeal that Paul makes to Philemon, what he says and why he's saying it, and I think we'll learn a great deal about what it takes to give this kind of encouragement in God's church. We're going to read verses 8 through 17. Philemon doesn't have chapter divisions, just the verses because it's short. But it's verses 8 through 17 that we'll read today. Therefore, Paul says, though I have enough confidence in Christ to order you to do what is proper, yet for love's sake I rather appeal to you, since I am such a person as Paul the aged and now also a prisoner of Christ Jesus. I appeal to you for my child Onesimus, whom I have begotten in my imprisonment, who formerly was useless to you, but now is useful both to you and to me. I have sent him back to you in person, that is, sending my very heart, whom I wished to keep with me so that on your behalf he might minister to me in my imprisonment for the gospel. But without your consent, I did not want to do anything so that your goodness would not be, in effect, by compulsion, but would be of your own free will. For perhaps he was for this reason separated from you for a while, that you would have him back forever, no longer as a slave, but more than a slave, a beloved brother, especially to me, but how much more to you, both in the flesh and in the Lord. If then you regard me a partner, accept him as you would me. Now Paul is making his request, and he starts it in verse 10. He states why he's writing, and he doesn't get to the specific request until verse 17. He gets a lot of stuff in before he says what I want you to do. He gives you the subject, but then he gets all the way down to verse 17 and he says, accept him as you would me. Now all through this letter, this is just very compelling stuff, very well worded, very wise. And I want to think first about this kind of appeal in a general sense. Because there are at least three important prerequisites that have to be here before this can happen. What you see when you read this letter, so different from our other New Testament books, so different a lot of the time from the way we talk with each other, even in the church. For this to happen, some things have to be in place. This kind of loving appeal depends somewhat on the character of the listener. We noted last week that Paul had complete confidence in Philemon, that he was a genuine believer in Jesus Christ. That means that he has the necessary character to receive this kind of admonition He can hear this and embrace it and put it into practice in his life because he had already been changed from within. His heart was not the way it was when he was lost. He's a new creation. And this is how it is. If you've had all your sins forgiven forever by the work that Jesus did on the cross, then you're able to forgive. You're able to demonstrate grace. You're able to show mercy and have compassion. If you're dealing with someone who's not a genuine believer, then what's happening in this letter cannot happen because the person receiving the letter wouldn't be capable of making it happen. Your appeal might sound the same because there is a standard that we have to hold up even to a lost person, and we don't always know if they're saved or lost. So the appeal would be the same, but the response could not be there. The right response can't be there if the person is lost. All this appeal would do in the life of a lost man or woman is demonstrate their inability to live a righteous life and would be for you a precursor to evangelizing them. It would show that they can't produce the righteousness of God, that they have to bow themselves before God and receive from Him what only He can do in their lives. And so if you're dealing with a lost person, it gets really different from what this letter is supposed to accomplish. It depends on the character of the listener, but it also depends on the content of the appeal itself. What you're asking for, if you're going to make the kind of appeal that's in this letter, has to be biblically valid. It's the kind of thing that has to be a truly biblical standard. You have to be trying to accomplish something that's best for everyone and that glorifies God. If you're in a church, and you've all heard about churches that split over the color of the paint, you know. Let's say that you want everybody in the church to be really excited about a particular paint color, to be enthusiastic about it, to embrace it as the right paint color. And you try to admonish them like this. Well, it won't happen. If they decline, you don't have the right to conclude that they're evil. The appeal is flawed. And it doesn't have to be that drastic to be flawed. It just has to be selfish and temporary and unimportant or something else aside from what's best for everybody and what glorifies God. One of the things that makes this letter work, and a key thing that makes it work, is that Paul is appealing to right things. Things that everybody ought to do. Things that glorify God. Things that are really a biblical standard, not a personal preference. So if you're going to ever accomplish anything like this letter accomplished in this man's life, then the listener will have to be a Christian, and if it becomes evident that that's not the case, then you switch to an evangelistic effort. The content of your appeal has to be right. And then the third prerequisite that makes this possible is the character of the speaker. The ability to encourage and admonish faithfully within God's church depends an awful lot on the godliness of the person who makes the appeal. He or she has to be a genuine believer with godly character. What I'm saying by this one is that what Paul is doing in this letter is not a technique that you could teach in a marketing class, and that anybody with reasonably good people skills could apply and get the result that they want. This isn't even in that category. What's happening here is not, if you follow this list, you'll get your way. You can't fake this. This depends on godly character in the person making the appeal. It's something that people recognize and trust. It's something that makes you willing to listen to somebody else. I believe him. I believe his life. I believe that she's the real thing. Therefore, even though I'm a little uncomfortable right now, I should stop and listen and think about this. That has to be there for the kind of power that comes through in this letter to be possible. You can't fake this. If you have this kind of character that Paul has, certain things come through when you talk, and people pick up on those things, and they tend to be more ready to listen to you. Now, what we have primarily in this letter relates to that third category. it's Paul's character that's most evident here. Paul's the one doing the talking, so that's naturally so. And what he says rests on a foundation of godliness that you and I need to be pursuing to be effective believers. If you need to make an appeal to another Christian, to challenge that other Christian, to try and help another believer as a part of your ministry within the body of Christ, then the only person in that arrangement that you have any real control over is yourself. And so this is what's in the letter, but it's also what's most helpful. We can only apply to ourselves and look to God to change other hearts. So with that in mind, I want to show you three ways in which you can check yourself before you step up to the plate and try to straighten somebody else out. Before you make this kind of appeal, it's always good to see if there's a log in your own eye. And just three things here that I see Paul doing that give us a good way to check ourselves, to see if we're right, if we're ready, and if this is going to be effective. The first of these ways to check yourself is what you hope in. Or another way to say this would be where your confidence lies. Why do you think this is going to work? And when you want something and you're anticipating getting it, there's some reason that you think you ought to have what you want, that everybody ought to agree with you and that this ought to happen. And that underlying reason will come out if you keep talking. You know, just keep talking and we'll see what's in there. And so the thing that you hope in is a driving factor that you can check. It's there and you need to know what it is. Where does your confidence lie? Well, in Paul's case, there's very clearly a reason why he thought his appeal was going to work and ought to be heeded. It's clear as we read the personal aspects of this letter that Paul wanted what he wanted very badly. I can relate to that. You know, if I want it, I want it. And I may change my mind next week and want something else, but this week I want this. And it can be really strong. And it comes through that Paul feels that. He wants these guys to do this. He's involved emotionally in the outcome of this request. It's very personal. But underlying all of that is something much more important. There's a higher standard than Paul's desires or preferences or his expectations. It's clear if we read this letter that his hope lies in something beyond himself, something beyond these two men that he's concerned about. It doesn't begin and end with Paul. Look at verse 10 again. I appeal to you for my child Onesimus, whom I have begotten in my imprisonment, who formerly was useless to you, but now is useful both to you and to me. Now this is a little more subtle than some of the New Testament material, which would say, do this, do that, you must do this, Christians do this. A little more subtle than that. But in this you can see that Paul is asking Philemon to notice the change that has taken place already in the life of Onesimus. I appeal to you for my child Onesimus, whom I have begotten in my imprisonment, who has gotten saved, and I was there, and I see the change in him. And he wasn't useful, but now he's useful to both of us. He's asking Philemon to notice what God has done in this man's life. And he's pointing him to the change in their relationship between Philemon and Onesimus that must result from the change that God has brought about in this man's life. Now, throughout this letter, Paul's confidence comes through that it is in God and what God has done and what God will do in these lives. It's just through and through the letter, but particularly in this reference here. He trusts Onesimus. Paul trusts Onesimus. He believes he's real. Paul trusts Philemon. He believes that he's a real Christian. And Paul knows that real Christians respond well to truth. And so he believes that Philemon is going to respond well. Paul is confident that God works in the hearts of those he changes. So he believes that God is going to work in both of these lives. So he's not hoping in short-term things. He's not hoping in some selfish motive. When people feel compelled to control, to manipulate, to connive until they get their way, when people feel that they can orchestrate all of everyone else's decisions, it means that they're not hoping in what Paul is hoping for here. Their confidence does not lie in what Paul's confidence lies. You can't be this relaxed about something this important if you're trusting in yourself. If you're trusting in yourself, then you're going to try to squeeze them. You're going to try to control it. You're going to try to make it happen. So whenever we seek to force godliness on somebody else by our superior intellect or our power of persuasion or our ability to control, I'm going to pigeonhole you, man, you've got to do it, then we need to ask why. Why do I feel like I'm the one who's going to make this happen? It's good to check yourself. Where's your confidence? Are you hoping in a temporary result? You just want this? You know, I like this color paint. You hoping to look good? Man, I hit a home run with that guy. You should have seen me. That was awesome. You just want to win? I'm going to win this discussion if it kills both of us. Or do you hope that God will do something supernatural? And are you so confident that he will do it when he pleases in his people that all you have to do is nudge them and point them toward him? You feel like you got to make it happen? Or are you content to point them to God and watch what he is going to do in their lives? Paul gives such a beautiful example of a godly appeal. He does have a deep desire to see a specific result, but it's clear that his hope is in God and not in himself. And that makes it work. It comes through in everything he says in this letter. He believes that these guys can be trusted because he believes God can be trusted and God is at work in their lives. Now, if you believe that, then what is there to worry about? If I could believe this as much during the week as I can believe it when it's time to tell you what this means, I wouldn't be as uptight as I am. You know, I mean, Paul's there. God will do it. That's where we need to be. So when you make an appeal, check and see, what do you really trust? What do you really hope in? The second way to check yourself before you make the appeal is check what you're going to appeal to. The specific thing that you're going to ask for, you know, is it valid? Is that one of those prerequisites that I mentioned? Is it valid? The purity of your motives and your confidence in God are going to be demonstrated when you start giving your reasons why. Paul appeals to things that go far beyond this temporary world. In verse 10, he references the salvation of Onesimus. In verse 11, he mentions how this change makes Onesimus useful to Philemon. This was a word play. Onesimus means useful in Greek. It was a common name given to slaves. And so Paul is saying, useful was useless to you, but now that he's been changed, he's useful to you and to me. In verses 12 and 13, he references his own love for and need for Onesimus. Kind of puts it in perspective for you, doesn't it? Paul needs this guy. But then he says this in verse 14, but without your consent, I did not want to do anything so that your goodness would not be in effect by compulsion, but by your own free will. As important as this clearly is to Paul, he's not willing to presume on the friendship to get what he wants. He's not going to betray this man's trust. He's not going to compel him or seek to control his friend or take advantage of the circumstances to use his friend. He trusts Philemon and he believes in his faithfulness. And so he just appeals to his friendship. In verse 15, he references God's purpose. For perhaps he was for this reason separated from you for a while, that you would have him back forever. Now there's tremendous humility in the way Paul says this, and it's another glimpse of the wisdom he had in writing a difficult letter. Paul does not presume what so many spiritual leaders have a tendency to presume, and that is to tell you everything that God is doing. I know why God did this in your life, and you ought to see it. It's so clear, man. This is God doing this, and you know, tell you all of this stuff. Paul doesn't do that. He doesn't pretend to understand everything that God does. He says, perhaps this is why it happened. So without exalting himself as though he's the guy who knows everything about God, and you, idiot that I'm talking to, don't know anything about God, so I'm here to explain it to you. He very skillfully, with the word perhaps, reminds Philemon that God's sovereignty and providence must be considered in this situation. Who knows where to draw those lines, but you need to remember that God is sovereign and that God works providentially in our lives. And so without claiming to have perfect insight into all of God's mysteries, Paul points Philemon to the unavoidable reality that God does have a purpose in the stuff that is happening in your life, and you better not forget it. You need to remember that when you don't understand what's going on or when it's hard. Gently reminds him that every one of us is subject to God's providence. In verse 16, Paul again points to the change in Onesimus as a result of his salvation and how that fact changes the relationship between these two men. No longer as a slave, but more than a slave, a beloved brother, especially to me, but how much more to you, both in the flesh and in the Lord. I sat at my desk a good portion of this week thinking how different this is from appeals that I have heard through my life in church. In the name of Christian progress and unity. Man, this is different. This is beautiful. There's nothing in bad taste. There's nothing base. There's nothing short-sighted. There's nothing unrelated to the spiritual gain of everybody involved. Such a demonstration of godly character, appealing just to that which is biblically sound, that is good for everybody and glorifies God. When you're ready to make your appeal, you might want to check the points you're going to make and see if they're in this category. If there's a hidden selfish motive in your heart, then your list of reasons is very likely to point it up to you and maybe save you an embarrassing situation. Godly character is demonstrated in what you hope in. It's demonstrated in what you appeal to. The third way that you can check yourself before you make an appeal is in the category of what you leave out. What is it you're not willing to appeal to? Look at verse 14. But without your consent, I did not want to do anything so that your goodness would not be in effect by compulsion, but of your own free will. Now, Paul is very carefully refusing to manipulate Philemon. It seems that he believes, if you just read the letter and sort of take the flow of it, the tenor of it, it seems that Paul believes Philemon would willingly give him this man's services for any period of time that he wanted. Relationship seems to be that close. It's the kind of thing where you figure the answer is going to be yes. And yet, Paul didn't have a way to ask because he's 1,000 miles away. And if he had kept Onesimus while letters went back and forth, then he would have had this man's services for weeks without having obtained permission. And if the answer was no, it'd be like, oh, well, sorry. But you still had it. And so Paul very studiously avoided that kind of compulsion. Now, this is important to somebody who has some power like Paul had. He wouldn't do it. He wouldn't go there. He would not force it. He would not manipulate his friend. And so he sends Onesimus back with the letter. Now, the wording of verse 14 is very specific, and there's a reason for it. It says, so that your goodness would not be in effect by compulsion. What it means is I don't want any compulsion, but I don't even want it to look like there's compulsion. This has to be completely above reproach. I'm not willing even to have an appearance of manipulating you. I would rather have the guy here with me, but I'm just not willing to go there because it would look like I was presuming on you, and I'm not going to do that. Now, again, this is a little different from how some people try to motivate you, even in God's church. So many people are willing to orchestrate things so that you're going to look like you're in league with the devil himself if you don't agree with them. You know, they're going to, well, if you love God, then you'll see it my way. Sometimes more subtle than that, but that kind of pigeonholing. I've known men who are willing to deceive by holding back key information. What they did say was true. They just didn't say the part that would have made it clear that they were in the wrong. Couching the truth in a questionable way. You have to ask yourself why. Why am I even tempted to go there? There must be some selfish motive that would make me do that. But Paul won't do it. He won't squeeze, he won't push, he won't pressure, he won't presume. He won't withhold information. He's up front and forthright. He's bending over backwards to make sure there's no sinful pressure for him to get his way. Character is demonstrated in what you won't do. If you trust God and you trust other believers and you believe that God works in the hearts of his children, then you can relax and watch to see what he does. And you nudge. You point him in the right direction. You don't start Matthew 18 church discipline before they've even had a chance to do the right thing. So this is what Paul is doing here. He's just nudging them. He's pointing them the right way. You can tell the godliness of the request by what he hopes in, by the specific things he asks for, and by what he refuses to do to get what he wants. Now, all of that can be summed up with one very simple word, and it's love. 1 Corinthians 13 is the definitional passage of love in your Bible. Turn to that with me, if you would. 1 Corinthians 13, we'll read from verse 4 through the first part of verse 8. 1 Corinthians 13, begin with verse 4. Love is patient, love is kind, and is not jealous. Love does not brag and is not arrogant, does not act unbecomingly, does not seek its own, is not provoked, does not take into account a wrong suffered, does not rejoice in unrighteousness, but rejoices in truth, bears all things, believes all things, hopes all things, endures all things. Love never fails. Now, I would submit to you that this is what's lacking with other motivational techniques that are so radically different from Philemon. This is what's wrong if we don't pass the test when we check ourselves. There's a lack of love. What Paul is doing is exactly this. This is what he's doing in the letter of Philemon. He's being patient. He's being kind. He's refusing to act unbecomingly. Although he wants a certain result, he's not seeking his own way, but he's seeking for God's glory. He rejoices in the truth. He believes all things. He trusts these men. He believes they'll do the right thing when they see the truth. He hopes all things. He's confident in their future for the same reason. This is what Paul's doing, and this is what Paul is asking Philemon to do. Not to keep a record of wrongs, not to be provoked, to receive Onesimus with Christian love, believing in what God has done in his heart, believing and hoping for a great future for this guy in a great relationship in spite of the past, enduring all things, even the ridicule from the town folk. Now, this is how we're to be. God has given us to each other in his church. You and I will never be what we are supposed to be unless each of us is faithful to do the kind of thing Paul is doing in Philemon. Unless each of us is willing to receive this kind of encouragement and to give it when it's time to give it. Paul shows beautifully how to do it. Hoping in the right things, challenging the right things, leaving out the right things. It's real love. And it's the standard for everybody in God's church. I'm always encouraged as I study passages like this. Paul does this a lot, where you can tell he's pretty vested in the outcome, but he still knows God has to do it, and he believes God will do it. And that's what it really comes down to. I can get past anything if God does this work in my heart. I can forgive this. I can get past the embarrassment. I can be reconciled. I can have mercy. If I was the guy that was wrong, and now I'm embarrassed for coming back into this situation and having to apologize and wondering what everybody's thinking of me, I can get through that. Only when God does a work in my heart to help me push that pride away and glorify Him and acknowledge my failings. This is the only way a church can look on when somebody else has a conflict and glorify God and not start taking sides and pointing fingers and whispering and gossiping. It's to let the Spirit of God sift out of our hearts all of those sinful motives. Trust Him to do His work in His children. So that's my call to you today. Trust God to work in the hearts of His children. He will do it. Let's bow.